Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
New Books in Southeast Asian Studies is sponsored by the ANU Southeast Asia Institute, the Griffith Asia Institute, the New York Southeast Asia Network, the Nordic Institute of Asian Studies, and the Sydney Southeast Asia Centre.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to New Books in Southeast Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Patrick Jory. I teach Southeast Asian History at the University of Queensland, Australia, and I'm co-host of this channel. The city of Chiang Mai in northern Thailand has become the destination for a growing segment of the international tourism market, religious tourism. International tourists visit Buddhist temples, volunteer as English teachers, discuss Buddhism with student monks, and experiment with meditation. While such interactions may appear to be yet another case of the commodification of Buddhism, Brooke Shednick argues that the phenomenon of religious tourism in Buddhist Chiang Mai is another way in which Thai Buddhism is adapting to a more globalized, market-oriented society. And it may even constitute a new opportunity for Buddhist missionary work. Religious Tourism in Northern Thailand, Encounters with Buddhist Monks, published by University of Washington Press in 2021, has been shortlisted for the EuroSeas Humanities Book Prize for 2022. Today I'm talking to the book's author, Brooke Shednick. Brooke is Assistant Professor of Religious Studies at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee. Brooke, thanks so much for coming on New Books in Southeast Asian Studies to talk about your book.
You're welcome, and thank you, Patrick, for reading the book and letting me talk about all of its arguments and ideas here.
Can I start off by asking you how and why you became interested in Buddhism in Northern Thailand in particular?
Yes. So I have a religious studies background from my undergraduate and graduate degrees in the United States. And when I was pursuing dissertation fieldwork, I conducted that throughout Thailand for my first book on international meditation centers. And during that time, I lived in Chiang Mai for the dissertation research. But then after I completed that research, I kept living in Chiang Mai, and I didn't leave for another 8 years. And so that a period of time was really significant for my understanding of Thai Buddhism, you know, developing further understanding, and also the conceptualization of this project. So during that time, once I graduated with my PhD, I was teaching and working in Chiang Mai, teaching study abroad students at Chiang Mai University. And so out of the experience of living in my, like within the research site, came this book. And, you know, because I'm living in contemporary Thailand, that has always been my interest, is in the contemporary period. And so I think that this book is unique because instead of traveling back and forth from my, you know, university, which, you know, most, you know, my university, you know, eventually became outside of Asia. But, you know, before moving away from Thailand, like I did in 2017, I didn't have to go back and forth. I was there the whole time. So I was able to really make lots of contacts and kind of figure out the project that I was going to do. So that's when it started. After I graduated, I started thinking about this in 2013. because I had been researching about meditation centers, but I was thinking about what are the other types of ways for tourists to engage in within Buddhism, because that's what I was noticing, what monks were also interested in as well, because I was teaching the undergraduate students from abroad, and I was connecting also with student monks who were pursuing their degrees at the monastic universities. And so that's kind of the kind of background to the conceptualization of this book.
Yes, you have a long-standing interest in Buddhism and tourism in Asia, and you've published earlier books which also touch on this theme. What draws you to this particular theme?
Yeah, it's not because I like tourists, because I'm much more interested in the monastic institution and the monks and the student monks, and I think you can see that in this book, because I have the first four chapters are about Buddhists and Buddhist monks, and then the fifth chapter is about tourists. I'm not really within tourist studies, and I haven't done like training within anthropology of tourism, although I think that stuff is really cool. My focus is on religious studies, but I think because of my interest in the contemporary period and the fact that I was like kind of working with tourists in a way, as I was working with my students, they weren't exactly tourists, but they were kind of in the mold of tourists in that they're here for a short time. They were there in Chiang Mai for a short time, and they were interested in what they could learn while they were there and what kinds of things they could experience. And so having to facilitate some of their learning and some of their trips made me understand and kind of see the different options for tourists in Chiang Mai, and then made me also think about and question the student monks and the other senior monks who were creating these programs that were meant to engage with tourists.
One of the really interesting parts of the book I found is this. When we think of Thai Buddhism generally, I think it tends to be understood within a quite nationalistic framework for reasons we don't have to go into. But in your book, we find that many of the student monks that you interview, they come from other parts of Buddhist Southeast Asia, Vietnam, Cambodia, Myanmar, and indeed other parts of Buddhist Asia. And of course, the tourists come from all over the world, especially Western countries, but other places as well. And the discussions, the conversations, teaching is done predominantly in the English language. So it's an example of a much more cosmopolitan expression of Thai Buddhism that we might be familiar with. Was that something that motivated you to write this book?
Yeah, I definitely think so. And I think that that's why I try to highlight that this is a kind of particular version of Buddhism that is taking place in Thailand. And so some of the monks are not Thai, they're not from Thailand, and they don't speak Thai, or they learn Thai when they arrive and they live in their temples. But because they're part of Thai Buddhism for at least 4 years, at least for some of the monks when they come to study in college, that they become unfamiliar with and understand Thai Buddhism. But the kind of issue there is that they came to Chiang Mai in order to learn in English, which is something like learn through their monastic education and learn in English, which is something that they can't do in most of the other countries. And then the people who become the most important tourists then are the ones who are English speaking, because they can provide that kind of extra enrichment to their education. And that's part of the reason why Chiang Mai has become that's the whole kind of conceptualization of the book, that this need for education for the monks and this like boom in tourism like created this real synergy that allowed for this kind of creative ways of thinking about Buddhism to engage with tourists, to help tourists understand Buddhism, and also to help the monks be able to explain Buddhism in English and then just also learn English in general. So I talk about in one of the chapters how the monks are, in particular, that because they're student monks, they're really focused on a kind of like more of a modern Buddhist, understanding of Buddhism that they're giving to the tourists. They're focused on you know, they want to explain the monastic lifestyle, but that's not really as important to them as telling these tourists about the things that they think are the most important about Buddhism. And because they're student monks and they're studying Buddhist doctrines, they want to like really teach them and let them know about these great Buddhist doctrines, and they want them to practice meditation. And so I tried to make clear that if we're looking at like all of Thailand, you're not going to see like this version of Buddhism, because we have other studies of like forest monks and these kinds of charismatic Kruba monks, and we have magic monks. And so there's all different kinds of monks, but this is like a study of student monks, and the fact that they're studying English and that they're in this kind of urban tourist environment really affects the kind of Buddhism that they're able to promote or discuss with the tourists for this, you know, for this particular audience.
Yes, the main subject of the book, of course, is the student monks. Can you tell us a little bit more about them, who they are, what their background is, where they come from, and why they come to Chiang Mai?
Yes. So in the book, I have a range of monks. The monks that are kind of like on the younger end of the spectrum are novice monks from monastic high schools, because I did look at some of the lower types of monastic education, not only in college. And then the student monks that are in college, so monks in undergraduate degrees, you know, going for their bachelor's. And so some of those were novices, and then some of them were turned 20 and become bhikkhus, or some of them are older and they also are, you know, had already been bhikkhus for a while, fully ordained monks. The other monks that are involved in these programs and involved in this study is senior monks, monks who are educators in these monastic education environments. They're principals of these schools and, you know, kind of senior members, like facilitators that are needed for the programs for tourists, like the volunteer tourism that I discuss in most of the chapters, and also the monk chat program that happens in the colleges, the college temples. And
yes, I was.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
Sorry, I was going to ask you about this, the monk chat program. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, that program began in the early 2000s, and it was because of this interest from the tourists. So that, like, going back to our earlier questions, that's why for me it was hard to kind of ignore tourism. I wasn't like necessarily going out trying to make a study about tourism, but it was just like, you know, what was happening in this area. So as I was told where monk chat began at Wat Suan Dok, which is where the Maha Chul Long Khon Buddhist Monastic University is located, that I guess tourists were coming in the early 2000s, maybe, you know, just to look at there's a kind of beautiful vista of pagodas, white pagodas with, like, you know, the sunset in the background. It's kind of a beautiful, dramatic scene there. And it's kind of right in the old city, and there are lots of monks walking around all the time. And so I think some tourists went in, and they were kind of continually asking questions about what was happening or about Buddhism. They're interested. And so eventually one of the foreign teachers at the university partnered with one of the senior monks, and they together created the monk chat program. And that has been going on, yeah, for the last, you know, 20 plus years at Wat Suan Dok. And that has become really important for student monks. They know about it from their, you know, older peers, tell them about it, you know, their older, you know, siblings or family members from other countries, from, you know, Myanmar and Cambodia and Laos. And they hear about this program, and it makes them want to study there, because they can practice their English and improve in English so quickly if they come to this, you know, and sit and listen and talk to these tourists for a couple hours each week. And so it's really important it became important for recruitment for the university. And then the other university, the Maha Makut Buddhist University at Wat Chai Luang, also then started a monk chat program, and also for their university students, their monks. And then at Wat Sisupan, they started a monk chat program, because especially on Saturdays is when the walking street happens, right, and passes very close to Wat Sisupan. And so already like the tourists were passing by, and they also had student monks that usually live in that temple that are studying at one of the universities. And so they run a monk chat program there too. And so it benefits the tourists, and it's places where the tourists are going to be coming anyway. And then it definitely is benefiting those student monks. So that's why that program emerged.
Can you tell us something about the international tourists who apply to these programs? Who are they, and where do they come from? What's the reason they are interested in these programs?
The international tourists, the ones who come to Monk Chat, are, I mean, there's just a real variety of people, just people looking for a day trip to a temple and adding a little bit of extra knowledge onto that. There's people that come to Monk Chat that are ones who speak English. And so that's why it's a little bit exclusive, in that I talk about the Chinese tourists in one of the chapters. And so they can't really participate. You can't really participate if you don't know English. So lots of tourists from North America and Australia and Europe are there, you know, sitting down and talking to monks for, you know, however long they want to. And then they leave. But because this group was so transient, I focused more on volunteer tourists, because they come and they work to teach English in monastic high schools for at least a period of a few weeks. So because they are able to stay for slightly longer, I had more opportunities to talk to them, and they had more thoughts about what, you know, they were learning about Buddhism, what they were experiencing. But the tourists who just came to talk to somebody for a half hour, an hour, you know, there wasn't as much, you know, information that I could think to retrieve from them. The other group of tourists that come would be student groups, like student groups studying, like educational tours, like kind of like what I run and, you know, helped while I was living there to run. And there's some gap year programs also that come by. Chiang Mai is a really good place for these kinds of programs because of these cultural exchange programs are so easy to tap into. So if you have a teacher and a class, it's very easy to get this kind of experiential experience for your class. And so those were the main kinds of tourists that I, you know, talked with and discussed in the book.
In your analysis, you divide the international tourists into four groups: the Westerners, the Chinese, Muslims, and missionaries. Can you tell the listener about the differences between these groups and the different kinds of interaction that the student monks have with each of these groups?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was an interesting part of my research, and that's in chapter three, when I talk about the religious others and the Buddhist eye. And I, like I mentioned before, this is mainly Western tourists who are coming into the Monk Chat. This chapter, I think, is mostly about Monk Chat, so the college student monks. And, you know, that's what I would observe, and that's what they would say. And I look at their guest books, you know, these are the countries that these people are coming from, you know, because it's an English program, so you have to know English. And so those were like the main group of tourists that the monks knew about. But I wanted to also ask them about these other groups, because they weren't necessarily, you know, populous, but they were still around as tourists, and they were, and, you know, and part of Thai society. And so I wanted to hear what the monks had to say about them and how they would contrast them with the kind of, you know, regular tourists who they would think of as the Western tourists, who they would mostly categorize as Christian. So they would think of them as Christian, as Christians who were like open and interested in Buddhism. And then during the time, like around 2015 is around the time when Chinese tourists from mainland China came into Chiang Mai in big numbers. And that's because of this movie that featured Chiang Mai in China. That was a big hit, and that was called Lost in Thailand. And so people wanted to come to Chiang Mai. It hadn't really been on the radar before for mainland China. But of course, like in southern Thailand, the ethnic Chinese from Malaysia and Singapore have been, you know, are part of the tourism landscape for, you know, decades. But this was very new for Chiang Mai to have these tourists from mainland China. And they were very different from the Western tourists. And then I also wanted to hear what the monk said about the Muslims because of the issues with Buddhist and Muslim violence and conflict in southern Thailand. And also some of the monks that are attending monk chat are Rakhine monks. So some of them would be knowledgeable about the conflict in the Rakhine state in Myanmar, so between Buddhists and Muslims. So I wanted to hear what they would say about Muslims and whether Muslims ever come or what they, you know, would think if a Muslim ever, you know, entered into monk chat because of these issues that they were kind of on the periphery, right? Because we're in northern Thailand, so it's not right there, but it's still something that they were aware of. And then the last group was the Christian missionaries, whom I didn't realize or know came to monk chat until like some of the monks would just sometimes mention it. And I then started to really ask them more systematically about these Christian missionaries and, you know, what they were doing and why they were coming to monk chat. So I got all of their attitudes and opinions on those different groups. Do you want me to summarize what their ideas were about the groups?
Yes, please.
Okay. So yeah, like I mentioned, the Western tourists were kind of like their standard tourists that they were like kind of used to, and they would like refer to them like Farang. They would call them Farang, like in Thai. They would say like these are the, you know, normal. They would say like these kind of words, the normal tourists that were the kind of the basis and the jumping off point for the other groups. And I called the Western tourists, the Farang tourists, the beneficial other, because they provide the English and they provide the opportunity to express about Buddhism. And the monks found them for the most part very open and interested in Buddhism and, you know, really were understood how to talk to the Western tourists. But for the Chinese tourists, the student monks noticed them around the temple, but they didn't notice them being engaged in Buddhism the way that they were used to from the Western tourists. They didn't notice them being interested in coming to monk chat or participating in any of the, you know, looking around the temple or being like, seeming like they're interested in the space of the temple. Instead, they would mention how the Chinese tourists would just like take a picture, you know, get off their bus and take a picture and then go back on the bus. So they didn't really see like the real authentic engagement that they were used to from the Western tourists. And so that's why I called them the familiar other, because they were the monks, kind of the student monks, reason that they were used to Buddhism. It wasn't that different for them. So that's why they weren't as interested and open in learning about Buddhism, the Thai Theravada kind of Buddhism. And so Muslims, I called the distant other, because the monks just, some of them would just say like, no, I've never met a Muslim. I've never seen a Muslim here in coming into monk chat. And they would be like a little bit, you know, talk about it like they would be afraid if a Muslim would come in because of the things that they had heard about violence between Buddhists and Muslims. But the ones who had met Muslims were very surprised, happily surprised, that they were, the ones that they met were so open and nice and wanted to share about Islam with them, about Buddhists, and compare the religions together. So there was a kind of positive outcome for those who had been able to meet some Muslims from various countries. But the Christian missionaries, for the most part, the monks had very, for the most part, negative attitudes towards, because they felt like the Christian missionaries came in to debate with them. And that's why I call them the competitive other, because they came in, the Christian missionaries, they felt were coming in to kind of attack Buddhism and prove that Christianity was the better religion. And the monks were not like aware of this. They didn't have any knowledge that this is, you know, what these people were going to be doing. And so they weren't prepared. And they felt very, whenever they recalled it, they still felt very upset about it. And they would like plan, like, next time I see them, you know, I'll know who they are and I'll tell them this about Buddhism. So they felt like they were kind of in competition with those Christian missionaries.
The monks are, of course, all male, yet the tourists are a mix of men and women. Did you notice differences in the way that male and female tourists experience Buddhism in Thailand?
I mean, the only real difference was whenever, like, especially women volunteers, tourists would be told, you don't remember, don't touch a monk. You can't, you know, go that close to a monk. But otherwise, these student monks are very, they're kind of used to being around women because they're in the city. They have, even more recently, they have lay students that are in the classroom with them studying. And some of them are women in both the universities. At Wat Son Dok and Wat Che Luang. So they're used to being around women and they're not as strict about the distance as like a forest monk would be. So I don't know if the tourists, you know, experience that so differently. The only thing that I usually notice, of course, is about women will say things like the female tourists will notice when they can't enter into a certain area of northern Thailand temples that have like a restriction on women, which would be some of the ordination halls. And then at Wat Che Luang, the pillar, you can't go into the spirit pillar for a woman. And sometimes they would ask the monks about that, like, why is that the case? And the monks would try to answer, but they didn't, you know, they didn't always have, there's not really a satisfying answer to a Western woman on this. So that was something that they noticed. You know, they were kind of hoping and looking for equality among, you know, within Buddhism. I think a lot of Westerners think that Buddhism, it's going to be an equal, you know, a different kind of religion that promises equality, and then they get kind of disappointed when it's not.
Looking in from the outside, some might wonder whether international tourists may be taking advantage of these young, perhaps naive novice monks. But in the book, I think you stress the agency of the monks. And in fact, arguably, in some respects, it might seem that the monks have the upper hand in that relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in some of the cases, I think that they do, because, I mean, they're in charge of their temples and the tourists are the ones that want to enter as one of their tourist activities. So, yeah, I think that if you consider like the kind of the power, the economic power of the tourists, then it might seem like the temple might let the, you know, it could be assumed or it could be possible that the temple would let them come in and do what they would want to do in this environment. But in fact, the temple tries to, all of the city temples in Chiang Mai that are, you know, considered like tourist temples that have a lot of tourists that come regularly, they really work hard to maintain the kind of the sacred atmosphere of the temple. And, you know, by sacred, I don't mean like it has to be silent all the time. You know, that's not the way a Thai Buddhist temple is, but sacred from the Thai Buddhist, like lay person's perspective, that this is a place where you can go and meet monks and make merit, and that has a certain level of respect in terms of behavior and clothing that people are wearing. And so the temple work, each of these temples that I looked at really work hard to create this environment through signs, through officials, through security that let tourists know, you know, how to behave in this space, and through these programs where the monks can also explain, you know, what's expected in a temple, and through the economic resources that the temple is able to garner from the tourists. And so they started to enact fees, especially when the Chinese tourists came in big numbers. They started to enact small fees like 20 baht, 30 baht. You know, these are like, you know, a dollar or less, a US dollar. And they wanted to make sure that the tourists were paying their share, because if so many tourists are coming, then they need, the temples were, some senior monks were telling me that, well, that the tourists then are not making donations for the most part. They're not making donations to make merit like Thai Buddhists would. So instead, if they pay a fee, then they can help to pay for the electricity. They can help to pay for some of the maintenance of the temple, some of the hiring of staff that's needed to clean the temple and, you know, provide for the, you know, water and education of the monks and some of the food for the monks. So they felt like that was something that they were able to do. And they also helped to benefit the community members by like leasing part of the like outside area of the temple to put up little shops so that when tourists come, they have a place to buy whatever kind of souvenirs or like drinks or something. along with other shops, like offering shops that would be for more for Thai Buddhists to purchase offerings to make merit. So the last part that they had agency in was in the allowing the volunteer tourists to come in. And so I highlight in that the chapter on agency, chapter two, about how volunteer tourism companies like really want to affiliate with the temple, and they need to talk to the principal, and the conditions need to be right within the school for the tourism company to be able to allow their volunteers to come in. And so they need the temple to be okay with this, to allow this. And some of the places, one of the places that I highlight decided that they didn't want the volunteer tourism company to send anyone anymore, and that they would find the volunteers on their own. And the other group was like very happy to align with the volunteer tourism company so that they could get some of those easy and free labor to come into their temple and help them to get some native English into their classroom spaces. So it was really up to the temple in many cases to create these programs and create these fees and allow certain tourists to come in for longer periods or not. So that's what I saw. And that's why I have that in my book.
In developing this theme of agency, you discuss a very interesting and, as you show, under-researched aspect of Buddhism, that is Buddhism as a missionary religion. And you argue that because missionary work tends to be associated with Christianity, and perhaps also Christian missionaries in the last two centuries have been associated with colonialism, the role of missionary work in Buddhism has been overlooked. Can you tell us about Buddhism's status as a missionary religion, and whether and in what capacity these monks see themselves as missionaries?
Yeah, that was another interesting part of the research and discussions with student monks, because it grew out of the idea of the cultural exchange programs, which were, they kind of have this dual purpose, and it's hard to say which one is the most important, but it was to, like I mentioned, especially, the beginning one, the first one, like monk chat, was that tourists were interested in Buddhism and monks needed to practice English, right? So it isn't only that they just want to practice English and talk about anything. The whole point of it is that tourists are curious about Buddhism. And this is the Buddhist missionizing ideal, that if people are curious, if people are interested about Buddhism, then it's the monastic duty to spread the Buddhist teachings to these people who want to know, who are ready to listen. And that's what these monks were doing in these cultural exchange programs. But the issue was that the monks wouldn't ever want to call themselves missionaries, because they had the idea of the Christian missionaries, which I just mentioned from the previous chapter about the religious attitudes, the attitudes to religious others. They had this competitive attitude with the Christian missionaries, and they could see how they acted. They could see that these missionaries were going out in order to convert people. And the student monks would say things like, these missionaries are trying to sell the religion. They're going out there and trying to convince people. So they had these kinds of ideas and, even metaphors of like economy, like they're trying to sell the religion. And the monks wanted to really move away from anything close to that. They didn't want to be seen as people who were trying to push anything on anyone. They, really had this kind of rooted in Buddhist ideas. From in the chapter on missionization, I go through different like textual examples, but the example of just like being available, being a resource for those who are curious, to share their experience with. And so that's what they would talk about for themselves, that they were available, right? Just like a monk on alms round just walks around and is not asking for food. They're just available for anyone who wants to give and make merit. And that's how these monks saw themselves. They're available for any tourist who wants to speak in English and learn about Buddhism. So these cultural exchange programs gave them this opportunity to spread the teachings, but they also contrasted themselves with Buddhist missionaries, part of like Thai Buddhist programs, like the Dhamma Tut, especially, that's still existing, where Buddhist missionaries would be sent abroad to establish Thai Buddhist temples, because they knew like we don't have a community that we're like serving as a missionary that's going to continually come back to us like those monks do who set up a temple abroad and live there for a long time. But they thought of themselves as planting seeds for the future. Like if somebody's interested, happens to come to Thailand, has the good karma to come into the Monk Chat program, kind of maybe randomly, but then it plants seeds when they talk to the monk about Buddhism and about the Dhamma. And then maybe they'll go back home and they'll pursue further. They'll read a book or they'll go to a temple. Or maybe it'll happen in the next life. But that was the way that they conceived of missionizing. And I hadn't, you know, really read too much in Buddhist studies scholarship about, you know, contemporary Buddhist missionizing, just a few examples that I give in the book. So I wanted to really highlight this as one of the significant interventions of the book.
One of the themes running through the book is the tension between the commercial venture or activity of tourism and the supposedly otherworldly nature of Buddhism. And it might be easy to think that through this religious tourism, Buddhism, you know, may become commodified. And I think, you know, much of the scholarly literature on Thai Buddhism tends to frown upon anything that has a whiff of commodification. But my sense is you don't seem to see it this way.
Yeah, I mean, because I'm looking at it from, you know, through the emic perspectives of the student monks. And so partly they're seeing the commercial, you know, that they would definitely contrast the commercialism or a commercial venture in Buddhist temples with the higher or the better, you know, way of practicing Buddhism or expressing Buddhism inside of a temple. In this this chapter, in chapter two about their agency, is when I delineate between the more of the younger monks who have this kind of idea that we don't need to be, we should kind of separate the sacred and the profane more. We should have Buddhism as just a religion that's based on donation, that has no kind of commercial activity to it whatsoever. And these student monks, I labeled their ideas like the rhetoric of enough, is what I said, because that's how they were talking about it. Like, we have enough. Like, we don't need more. We don't need these tourist fees. It doesn't feel good when a tourist has to pay money to enter a temple. It should be open to everybody. And we don't need more building projects in the temple. Everything's fine in the temple. And they felt satisfied, like they had enough. But some of the senior monks and teachers that I talked to that maybe had more experience and awareness of the temple finance situations had more of this rhetoric of deprivation that could see some connections between commercialism or, you know, some economic opportunities and the temple like coming together. As long as it kind of benefited the community, as long as it benefited the monks' education, they thought, you know, we have a little tiny fee or, you know, we have some commerce in the temple to support the community members, then that's okay. We can pay our electricity and our water. And that's all we're really doing it for. And so they all had these like different lines between the sacred and the profane. And they had different ways of creating that line. And I think that you can see this way of thinking about Buddhism and commercialism when you're looking at this kind of smaller study like I am, because my scope is on these city temples in Chiang Mai. And the money that I'm talking about it's like very small amounts of money that they're talking about enacting, for these like tourist fees or for this, you know, renting out space for selling products. And it's not the same kind of commercialism as Thai Buddhists talk about as like Buddha Panit, which means like Buddhist commercialism, which is more about really large scale selling, you know, the kind of bigger phenomenon of the selling of amulets, like ritual services that cost, you know, a certain amount of recommended donations. When you go into a temple and there's all this commerce, that's when people start to get upset about Buddha Panit. But what I'm talking about is, you know, something that can be more kind of debated. I think when people talk about Buddha Panit, that they've already decided it's bad, something that's bad for Buddhism. But if we look at the idea of the fees and just the smaller scale commerce at these city temples, then there's a little bit more of a debate that can happen. And it's not always something that's negative. Buddha Panit has a connotation of negativity to it.
Your account of the way that the student monks explain Buddhism to Western tourists is very interesting. You say that the monks like to emphasize meditation, which, as we know, has been going through a boom in the West in recent years, and you've actually written about this in another book. At the same time, in their explanations to the tourists, they tend to downplay other religious practices like devotional rituals and, you know, making merit, which ironically tend to be the usual activities of Thai Buddhists.
Yeah, it's true, because they're thinking about this audience of, you know, the kind of the typical Western audience, that this is what they're kind of giving back to them. They, you know, they're like receiving what they think they want and then kind of giving it back to them. So they know that Westerners like meditation, and they think that's great because meditation is seen as so hard for most Thai Buddhists. And so if like your interest is firstly in meditation, then that's like something to really just go with. And if that's the way that that's the way that they assume that most Westerners come into meditation, come into Buddhism, is through meditation. And then devotion and merit making can follow. But the other group, the Thai Buddhists or people who grow up as Buddhists, then they're going to come into Buddhism through devotion and through merit making and chanting and going to the temple. And then they might be convinced to try meditation. That's how they think of it. And I think it's, for the most part, it's pretty accurate for many people, the way that they've kind of divided these groups, and that it is hard to understand and think about merit when you are not having grown up as a Thai Buddhist. But meditation is something that these people are aware of, and they understand that it might have benefits beyond religious benefits. So the monks and also understand that, and they take that information and then they continue to encourage the Westerners to keep meditating. And then they want to, you know, eventually they believe if they do keep meditating, then that faith and that devotion will arise automatically afterwards.
It's tempting to think that for international tourists, a few weeks or even a few months teaching and interacting with the Buddhist monks, you know, might not make much of an impact. But you argue that in many cases it produces what you call a transformative experience. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, just looking at the different interviews and writings from the volunteer tourists I put together in the last chapter 5 about self-transformation and Buddhist authenticity through volunteer tourism, I go through 3 different stages or ideas that volunteer tourists have. And so the first is that this experience when they're in the temple is about difference. And so the experience matches their expectation, because the classroom experience is, you know, filled with monks wearing robes. And that's what the monks understood too. They were like, volunteer tourists want to come to us because of this, you know, because of the robes that we're wearing, and they don't ever get a chance to have students like this before. And if the volunteer tourists get to live in the temple, that's when they can really become friends with the monks, and they can tutor them after classes, and they can experience the environment, and they become kind of enchanted by the smell of incense and the chanting and the early morning sunrise and the monks walking and things like that. And they become like, this is what they kind of expected. But then at the same time, when they go deeper into beyond just the differences, and they see that the monks are not exactly what they expected. They're these really full human beings who have individual personalities and are not just perfect embodiments of monastic stoicism as they imagine. And they start to talk to them, and they get to know them. And instead of feeling like, oh, I've been, you know, kind of tricked, these monks aren't really like religious at all, like some groups might think who've just encountered these monks for an evening or something like that and saw them not behaving as they thought they would, because they're there and because they know them, then they feel like, I've understood something. I've come to like a real authenticity of the monastic environment that other people really don't get to experience. And when they can make these real connections with monks, and they can see that they're not just representations, but they're real people, that like kind of really gives them a real shift in their understanding of the world. They can also generalize to like all groups, that all groups are like this. We make all these kind of assumptions about groups of different cultures, but they all have these similarities and these kinds of authenticity that anyone can get to know if they're able to have these kinds of interactions and circumstances where they can get to know them and live with them for a while. But, you know, beside that just idea, at the same time, the volunteer tourists also had some Buddhist values that were able to be transmitted to them, including like they could notice the generosity of some of the monastic students in, you know, helping the teachers and helping the other students. They noticed their formality and respectfulness, you know, for and their respect for teachers. They noticed the behaviors of lay people towards the monk and the deference and devotion that people had. And they could, you know, really get some of those kinds of values of loving kindness, some of them mentioned, and generosity, you know, and that they could kind of take that home with them into their own worldview and incorporate it in their own ways.
Towards the end of the book, you deal with the question of authenticity. And for tourists, authenticity is always the mecca of the traveling experience. Maybe that's not quite the right appropriate metaphor for this conversation, but you know what I mean. Does religious tourism in Chiang Mai deliver an authentic experience of Buddhism?
Yeah, that's a hard question. Because, yeah, I mean, the monks, I think, are being authentic. They're trying to show themselves, and they're trying to show, yeah, if we think about authenticity as being who you are and wanting to show and express who you are, that's exactly what the monks are trying to do. And they live these Buddhist lives that they, when they express it, they're like, I live my monastic life, my Buddhist life, and that's all I can show. I can share with them what I experience. And so that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to express that authenticity to the tourists. But like we discussed, at the same time, they're giving a particular version because they know what the tourists are most interested in and what the tourists will most benefit from. Like some of the monks wouldn't necessarily want to talk about the monastic life all the time, like all these details about the monastic life, because they knew that the Western tourists weren't going to be ordaining, you know, for the most part, that's not what they're going to do. And so they thought they're kind of selecting then what's the best way to tell them about Buddhism, to tell them about my experience, but in a way that's going to be the most impactful and beneficial for them.
Before we conclude, this podcast channel always puts a bit of pressure on our interviewees by asking them if they are working on a new project and if you could tell us what that project is about.
Yeah, sure. I mean, this book came out in 2021. I've been working on it since 2013. So yes, I am happy to work on new things now. And I have a book that I wrote like during the pandemic when I couldn't go to Thailand. I wrote a book about like an introductory book to Theravada Buddhism, and it's coming out with Shambhala Publications. It's called Living Theravada, Demystifying the People, Places, and Practices of a Buddhist Tradition. So it's like for travelers or for students who want to know about Theravada Buddhism in mainland Southeast Asia, putting together like more about all the different contemporary lived Buddhism that I don't think you get in too many introductions to Buddhism. And then for my scholarly work, I've been looking at for a while, I've written some articles on it, but I'm working on eventually working towards a book project on the perceptions and meanings of the monastic body in Thailand and the different ways of performing monasticism and how that's received by the lay population.
Brooke Shednack, thank you very much for joining us on this episode of New Books in Southeast Asian Studies to discuss your new book, Religious Tourism in Northern Thailand, Encounters with Buddhist Monks, published in 2021 by University of Washington Press.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to New Books in Southeast Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Thanks, everyone, for listening. If you enjoy this episode, there are other podcasts about books that deal with Buddhism in Southeast Asia, including Brooke's earlier book, Thailand's International Meditation Centers, Tourism and the Global Commodification of Religious Practices, published by Routledge in 2015, or Julia Casaniti's Remembering the Present, Mindfulness in Buddhist Asia, published by Cornell University Press in 2018. You can download or stream this interview and thousands more free of charge via the New Books Network website or iTunes.